Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Loeb & Loeb webinar, advertiser-sponsored social network conference call. Today's call is being recorded. And now at this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Jim Taylor. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay. Good morning or good afternoon to everybody. We're delighted to be able to present this Advertiser Social Networks webinar to you. First of all, start by introducing myself. Some of you may know me. My name is Jim Taylor. I'm the head of the entertainment, New York Entertainment Department of Loeb & Loeb, and I am also chair of the Advertising and Promotions Group at Loeb & Loeb. I was to be joined today by my partner, Terry Seligman, but unfortunately, Terry is the death of a family friend, and she is attending the service and will be unable to participate, so it's solo for Jim. Let me just get a few administrative details out of the way for everyone. This webinar is providing CLE or the equivalent in New York, California, and Illinois. On Monday, we will be sending to you an outline and an evaluation form. The outline will have a complete detailed discussion of a lot of the legal issues that were raised here during this presentation and will expand on the PowerPoint presentation. The evaluation form is for you to tell us what you think of the program, and once we get that back, we'll be able to issue your certificate. If there are any questions that come up or arise on Monday, you can certainly contact Melanie Clark at Loeb & Loeb at 212-407-4137. Let me repeat that, 212-407-4137. So with that, let's start. The way I'm going to present this program is I'm going to talk through the PowerPoint, and then I'd like to leave plenty of time at the end for questions, and hopefully we can get to as many questions as we possibly can. Obviously, advertiser social networks are has been a boon in those, certainly in the last year, with the advent of YouTube, Facebook, MySpace, and a number of other community sites. Our program today is going to address the legal issues that advertisers have to face. It's a little bit of a, I think for many of you, you will appreciate this, a different animal for an advertiser running a social networking website in which there's going to be video sharing, blogs, user-generated content, than a YouTube or a Facebook. One of the key differences is obviously you have a very different kind of brand that you're looking to protect. And we're going to talk about those issues, and we're going to talk about some of the liability issues. But certainly, I'm sure many of you have either already launched advertising social networks or are presently contemplating them or contemplating expansion of those advertising social networks. What we thought would be the best way to approach this particular seminar, and let me tell you what we're not going to talk about. Our focus primarily is going to be on the issues associated with user-generated content, the issues as to advertiser liability on that on those advertiser community sites. We're not going to talk specifically about issues relating to privacy policy, email marketing issues related to canned spam, viral marketing issues, COPPA, or the specifics of the rules and their compliance for a contest or a sweepstakes offer on a community site, advertiser community site. Those are clearly, there's a lot of issues in and around that, but I think those would be too difficult for us to try to cover in this particular webinar. So we're really going to focus primarily on the user-generated content and the advertiser liability issues with respect to that user-generated content. What we thought would be the best way to approach this webinar is to really work with a hypothetical. And we came up with one involving a candy company. And as many of you can see on your screen, There is USA Candy Company, our company which was founded in 1818 and is North America's premier candy company. What USA Candy Company has developed is a new no-melt chocolate, which is revolutionary, and they're ready to launch it for the Valentine's Day. And they've realized that the best way to reach out is through the creation of an advertiser social network that is going to have a number of elements to it. Let's talk about what some of those elements are going to be. They're going to have a site that's going to be specifically dedicated to no-melt chocolate. It's going to be www.nomelt.com. The website's going to have a number of short movies featuring teen personality Polly Pucker, who the advertiser decided would be the perfect spokesperson for no-melt chocolate. She's going to travel around the world as part of a no-melt chocolate. She's going to take it to every kind of destination imaginable where chocolate would typically melt. The beach, the desert, next to a hot oven at a bakery, and prove that it doesn't melt. And she also has indicated to us that she really is such a believer in this chocolate that she thinks that there's no other chocolate that even comes close in terms of its no-mess features. So we're going to create a blog. The marketing people have come to us to create a blog. We're the lawyers, in many cases, who are going to be talking to them about these various issues. In addition, and you'll see on this next slide here, what the screen is going to look like when we finalize the site. This is what the marketing people have presented as what Polly Pucker's blog is going to look like, where it's going to reside on the site, and then next to it is going to be the various videos that she is creating. We ourselves might be creating some content for that, but our primary focus is going to be on the content that Polly Pucker is going to be creating. In addition to that, we know the value of promotions with respect to these advertiser social sites. And we're going to be creating a contest where we're going to ask people to describe how and where they ate no-melt chocolate and what their experience was. And we want them to be really creative with this. We want them to submit it in one of four categories. They can submit a video of themselves eating the no-melt chocolate, and the environment in which they ate it. We want a separate category is for pictures. Another category is for essays, what their experience was. And we also have the idea of them creating songs. We've decided that we may make available certain songs that we've identified in the public domain as being available for them to do parody lyrics for. But they are also welcome to create their own original songs. And we will take the five top entries, post them on the No-Melt website, and that's going to be in each category. Then we're going to choose a winner for public voting because we want to do this all in time for Valentine's Day. We also want to make use of word-of-mouth marketing. And who better for word-of-mouth marketing when it comes to chocolates than high school cheerleaders? And we've contacted cheerleaders in 10 high schools and offered to supply them with no-melt chocolate for 3 months. We want them to talk about it on their blogs. We want them to email information to their friends. We want them to, and we want to be able to post that information to our site. So we've got the hypothetical, and you'll see the next frame is what that proposed page is going to look like, where people can share their stories through the videos. And then, of course, you'll see later the page where the cheerleaders are going to be involved. So, as many of you know, with the sites, based on the sites that you presently have, is you're going to have terms of use and you're going to have a privacy policy. As I mentioned earlier, we're not going to talk about the privacy policies, but what are the things that we want to talk about in terms of use? We're going to get into that in more detail as we go through the presentation and focus on that a little bit at the end. But some of the things that you're going to start thinking about and you're going to ask your client about, again, putting yourself in the position of the lawyer for those who are the lawyer, or putting yourself in the position as a marketing person who is saying, what are the questions I need to clear through my lawyer and give consideration to? And some of the questions that you're going to ask are, just to start, is, well, who do we want to make eligible for this? Polly Pucker has a real appeal across the teen market, so we want to utilize her for that. So we're thinking about allowing people who are minors to make submissions, both in the contest and the cheerleaders themselves are actually minors. And what do we want to make in terms of guidelines for submission? How tight do we want to be? Do we want to permit, you know, kind of a free flow of information, whether it be in the contest or whether it be in the blogs that are going to be created? Or do we want to make sure that we exercise great control, because we are a company that has been around for well over 100 years, and we have a very, very carefully constructed brand that we are that's very important for us to protect. One of the other issues that we're going to be talking about is what are the ownership issues for the advertisers. Advertisers want to own anything that's obviously been created for their benefit or at their direction. The question that will come up, and we'll talk about this a little bit later in detail, are, do you need to own it? Does that have a chilling effect on the submission, particularly when you're dealing with music? And is it better just to get a license? And at the end of the day, is what we really care about here is our ability to use it, our ability to control it, and our ability to limit liability, or is it really absolutely critical that we in fact own it? So, with that, let's first outline some of the questions. You'll see the slide that's up presently is, what legal issues are raised by the No Melt Chocolate Marketing Plan? I'm sure some of these questions have already come to mind for you as well. Let's first talk about Polly Pucker's blog. We've indicated that the concern with a blog is, you know, by its inherent nature, it's something that's supposed to really reflect that person's personality, their point of view. But it is going to be a blog that she's going to create that's going to reside on our site. It's for us specifically. So the question will be, what's the right balance that we want to strike between giving her free rein to submit material, to put that material up, and wanting to not only protect our brand, but protect our exposure as an advertiser? So some of the questions that we're going to be asking ourselves is, okay, what if she plagiarizes from somebody else's travel? How do we guard against that? What if she writes about and includes pictures of other people? She's traveling around the world, and she shows other people. She may show monuments. You'll see that a little bit later. What is it that she's going to be doing, and how do we manage that and control that? And what if she disparages a competitor's product or makes inappropriate comments about someone else? She's indicated how passionate she feels about this chocolate. And we've kind of said to her, you know what, we're willing to take some, you know, we really want to consider the possibility of her making statements about some competitor's product. And akin to that, what if she also makes statements about what it does for her and has done everything from clearing up her acne to providing her with all sorts of other benefits? And then, of course, with related to all these questions becomes the issue of, do we review and edit Polly's blog and any user comments posted to the blog? One of the things that you'll see throughout this presentation that we're going to talk about is, and I'll just get it out there right now, what's your liability as the advertiser? I think you should work with the assumption that you, as the advertiser, if this is a site that is published by you, that you are going to be liable, that this is going to be deemed commercial speech made for you, made for your benefit, and that you're not necessarily going to be able to distance yourself from that. A staff attorney at the FTC, while not speaking formally on behalf of the FTC, has taken the position that anything that appears on your site, including user-generated comments, are really things that you have a responsibility to monitor and to control. They've also taken the position that you need to also monitor and control any links to your site, and that you need to actively be out there looking to see statements that are made about your products on other websites to make sure that they're not false or misleading. Now, I think a lot of us, as part of this chat, this webinar, would say, that's absurd, we can't do that. And that's not a formal position on the FTC's part. It's really been kind of a wait-and-see attitude on what they're going to see out there. But clearly, they've stated informally that if it's on your site and you have an ability to control what's on your site, you're going to be held liable, you're going to be responsible. So we're going to see that theme throughout this webinar and this presentation. So let's proceed with trying to address some of these questions. So we have, if Poly makes claims about no melt chocolate, do they need to be substantiated? Okay, let me see if we want to go back here and talk a little bit about, let's address some of these other questions first. Okay. With the understanding that, and we're going to get into this a little bit more when we talk about the copyright issues and the trademark issues, but let's give you quick answers or positions. And the reason I say positions as opposed to answers necessarily is that there's not a lot of case law on this presently. There are conflicting points of view about this. But as an advertiser, let's put out how we might advise you as to what the potential issues might be. What if she plagiarizes from someone else's travel writings? Are you potentially liable? Yes. I think you are liable, potentially. And so what you're going to want to do is have a way of ensuring that there is really, in essence, the answer to this last question here is the vetting. Are you going to want to review and edit Polly's blog? Yes, you are. You're going to want to do it for legal reasons, and you're going to want to probably do it for brand reasons. So you want to make sure that you are ensuring that what she writes is at least original, and that may be just a representation through her contract, and advising her of what the rules of the road are going to be and what she does with the blog. Typically, what you would do is say to somebody who's going to be writing a blog, here's the code of conduct that we are asking you to abide by. We want you to disclose who you are. We want to make sure that everything you post is accurate and original to you. We want you to be truthful. And a whole set of other criteria, and essentially a code of conduct. It's good citizens kind of conduct. What if she writes and includes pictures of other people, some of whom are celebrities? The issue is, do you have permission to use those celebrities' likenesses? The answer is, in all likelihood, that you're not going to, and so that becomes an issue. If she has a photo that she's taken of herself with somebody else, and she hasn't gotten a release, is there some exposure to you there? And certainly what you can do is provide her or have somebody support her in getting those releases. But the answer is going to be you're going to want to release on that. What if she disparages a competitor's product or makes inappropriate comments about somebody else? I think the position that I think we have to be focused on is that you in all likelihood somebody would take the position that you are liable for those comments. And that if she makes inappropriate comments about somebody else, and we'll talk about the Communications Decency Act in a moment, but if she's making claims about somebody else's product or about your own product, it's as if you, the advertiser, are making those claims. And that really answers the next question. So we've really concluded, at least as far as what we're talking about here, is do we need to really edit Polly's blog and any user comments posted to the blog? There's two issues you have there. One is Polly's blog and what you're going to be able to do there, as well as user comments. Do you really want to edit those comments? And we'll talk about that in the context of the Communications Decency Act when we get to that. So what are some of the other legal issues that are raised by the marketing plan and Polly Pucker's mini movies? We've talked about the claims about no melt chocolate. Do they need to be substantiated? I think the FTC's position would be yes, they do. What about some other issues that we may not have necessarily thought about when it was first presented to us? A good example is what are the guild issues? Polly Pucker is a SAG signatory, Screen Actors Guild signatory. Does that mean that any of the movies that she produces or the materials that she submits are going to have to be produced pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement. That is an open question, and you will find different positions from different people on that. I think certainly SAG has not even focused on these kinds of issues at the level of detail that we might even discuss here. But I think you should be aware that it is an open issue. I mean, one of the issues is if Polly is a SAG member and we're not a signatory, and Polly says, I can only work and do work for signatory agencies or making sure all the production is pursuant to a signatory, and you're either a non-signatory or the advertiser is a non-signatory, depending on if you're in the agency or the advertiser, how do you deal with that and how do you address that? One way to address it is say, we're not subject to the collective bargaining agreement, and Polly kind of get on board. But if her agent says, sorry, I need to know somebody's a signatory, and all the production is going to be done pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement, that becomes an issue that you're going to have to address. But let's say Polly doesn't raise that as an issue, but you yourself are a signatory. Does that mean that you're going to have to make sure that these productions that she creates are all pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement? Again, question mark. I think a lot of people out there right now would take the position, no, you don't need to, but it is an issue. And while I don't think that SAG is going to necessarily focus on this issue in the next, you know, couple of months, I do think at some point in time, if user-generated content and productions that are going to be directed towards community sites, I think the SAG issues are going to present themselves. So, we've talked about Polly Pucker and what are some of the issues with her, and we can deal with some of those issues with Polly Pucker simply through our contract with her, having some exercising some control over what she puts up on the blog and the like. But let's talk about what we want to do now with respect to our contest. Again, we're not going to be focused here on contest for the part of this webinar, contest rules. But there are clearly rules that will need to be in place that are going to have to be compliant with contest and lottery laws in all 50 states, assuming that that's the jurisdiction that you're working with. And that deals with issues such as making sure that there are criteria clearly established in each of these categories so people understand how their video, picture, essay, or song are going to be judged, as well as qualified judges and making sure that rules are properly submitted. So, what if users submit material that contains copyrighted materials or trademarks owned by someone else? There is exposure there. And typically what you want to do, the starting point and the best position for you to be in is to say, you may only submit materials that are owned by you and original to you. And that's typically what is done. However, what they may want to do, depending on the contest and your level of comfort with certain risks, is say, you know what, we're going to allow them to submit materials owned by other people, provided they have permission. The question and the challenge that you have is, how do you police the process and the forms by which they get permission? And how do you know that they've gotten permission from all the proper rights holders? You're not in control here. They are the ones that are in control of this particular piece. So that becomes an issue. There is some exposure there. One of the ways to deal with that is to really provide that if somebody is going to use third-party materials, that they have to get permission. You may decide that you're going to limit it only to certain types of copyrighted works, for example, video images as opposed to music. And I know music is one of our categories. And what you may do then is when you select the top five that are going to be posted for judging and public voting, is you may at that point decide to engage in a greater due diligence to make sure that all the necessary rights have been secured from the copyright holders and from the trademark owners. Let's talk about the next question. What if users submit material that contains defamatory statements about someone or includes footage or pictures of someone famous? Again, the question really is, do you need permission? The answer is, yes, you do. Now, obviously, defamatory statements is a separate issue from the right of publicity issue, and we're going to get into defamatory issues in a moment. with respect to the Communications Decency Act, but it's a little bit difficult to offer a promotion where, in many cases, where the person's only filming themselves. It's about a community, so you're going to perhaps give consideration to allowing them to film friends and the like. What do you have in place to exercise control over the permissions that they're obtaining to make sure that those people, in fact, have granted the consent? What if somebody submits a video showing them using no-melt chocolate under potentially dangerous situations? How do you deal with that? Typically, what you would do is in your guidelines and in your rules, you would say you may not do that. You may not submit anything that is pornographic, that is obscene, that shows the use of the product in manners inconsistent with how it was intended to be used. You may not use it in any way that shows it in dangerous situations. And certainly the question really becomes, if you put that video up, let's say, that shows somebody trying to melt it with a blowtorch, does that raise certain concerns for you in terms of your own exposure or liability? Would you then be concerned that somebody might replicate that action and therefore expose yourself to certain liability? So, what legal issues are raised by the No Melt Chocolate marketing plan? We've talked about some of these. We've got the word-of-mouth marketing by high school cheerleaders. Do the cheerleaders need to disclose that they're being supplied with No Melt Chocolate? If you look at the word-of-mouth marketing association guidelines and the testimonial guidelines, the answer would be yes. And again, because they are, whatever claims they make, you have to assume are going to be attached to you as if you, the advertiser, made them. So in other words, you're not going to be able to say, you know what, let's get other people be our ambassadors and not have to worry about what they say or what they do in the hope that they might be able to have a little more latitude than we ourselves can have. I think that's a dangerous practice and assumption to make. So let's get into some of the issues that I've alluded to in terms of copyright and trademark infringement. Because now we're going to talk about, okay, what's your exposure and what do you do to protect yourself? What can't you protect yourself from? Let me also start off by saying when you're dealing with user-generated content, there are certain things that you're probably not going to be able to secure from the start that are limiting in and of themselves. For example, if somebody else is creating content for your website, your insurance is not likely to cover that. So you won't necessarily be able to have the protection of the insurance. The other issue is, look who is submitting that content, and I'm sure this is obvious to many of you. You've got an individual who's submitting content, and while you may provide in the terms and conditions or in the rules that they have the obligation of an indemnity, what's the value of that indemnity? So let's talk about the copyright. The paper that you're going to be getting, and on these slides, we have a lot of detail about the different types of copyright. The point that I really want to make about this and introduce is the idea of the potential protection that may be afforded, could be afforded to you under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And what that can provide protection for is contributory or vicarious infringement. In other words, if you are an advertiser and you are taking submissions from third parties, the people who you've invited in to make submissions, you may have protection under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act for any claim of contributory infringement or vicarious infringement under the Safe Harbor. Now, what the Safe Harbor requires you to do is do certain things if you have certain conditions that are met. And I'm not going to get into too much detail about those because they're detailed really in your presentation and even more detailed in the paper that's going to be available to you on Monday. But it is something that you are going to want to include in any terms of use that provide for takedown and provide for certain protections. Now, here's the catch with the DMCA. It's not a blanket protection. It provides limited protections. It's certainly not going to protect you if there's a direct infringement, if you knew that it was infringing or should have known that it was infringing. And there's some issues about how do you know and what when knowledge is actually obtained. And oftentimes the cases that are brought under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's really brought up as a defense, saying somebody has brought a suit against you that says this is infringing. Your response as a defendant is that, no, we're protected under the DMCA safe harbor, and we should not have liability. So it has limited value to you. Now, one of the questions that sometimes comes up is an advertiser an actual service provider? And I think, while there's not been any real case law on that, I think you could take the position that if an advertiser owner controls a website that is making available infringing material, it could qualify as a service provider under the DMCA, as long as it is not involved in creating those materials that are being submissioned. So, in other words, third parties submit the materials to you, the website, you are the owner and controller of that website. I think you have a very good argument that you're a service provider. The other question, and you'll see this when you look at your materials, is one of the factors that goes to whether or not you can avail yourself of a safe harbor is whether or not you are benefiting financially from the availability of the infringing materials on the website. Potentially, a court could impute financial benefit to an advertiser if the infringing material directly contributed to an increase in the sales of its product. I'm not sure that that would necessarily, I don't think that's necessarily a likely result for a court, but it really depends on the nature of the site, what you're doing, and a number of other factors. The other factors that I think that would come into play were whether the advertiser is inducing individuals to view or download infringing material, whether the advertiser has embedded its logo in any infringing material. The key, I think, is separation, and obviously not editing that work and taking control of that work. One of the issues that sometimes comes up under the DMCA is people say, I shouldn't even, the vet or no vet, you know, should I, am I limiting my ability to use the DMCA as a safe harbor by vetting the materials that come through? My response to that would be that you need to find the right balance. I don't think that vetting is fatal to a DMCA at all. There have been cases that have provided that simply vetting the material and viewing the material doesn't necessarily mean that you lose a DMCA safe harbor. I do think, though, that if somebody were going to make a charge that you should not be protected by the DMCA, that they would say you viewed the materials and you vetted, and therefore you should not be, that would be a factor that they would throw in. I think the cases generally, I think, are leaning towards vetting doesn't necessarily make it fatal. And more importantly, and getting back to a point that we made before, it's your brand. You cannot be in the position, in many cases, of permitting work up there that you know is infringing, that is somehow negative or impacting the brand, and you need to exercise some control. So I think my own feeling in the present environment is that vetting doesn't really become fatal to a DMA safe harbor defense. You will find others out there who disagree with that, by the way. So let's talk about, I'm going to skip through some of these safe harbor, but clearly what you have to do, if you look at the screen presently, is the threshold requirements for an online service provider are to implement and inform users of its policy for the termination of repeat offenders, accommodate and not interfere with standard technical measures, and while it says here you don't have a duty to monitor, it doesn't mean monitoring is fatal. So let's then skip through those slides, because again, I think those are very technical. They're very useful information for you when you construct your DMCA policy. We've talked about, will an advertiser qualify as a service provider? I think you've heard my position on that. Will an advertiser to be found to benefit financially from the infringing material? potentially it's a factor. It could undermine your ability to make use of that DMCA offense. What if the advertiser monitors, removes, or edits material? Again, monitoring, removing material I don't think is a problem. Editing becomes a little more dangerous, and it's going to be depend on the type of editing that is done and the materiality of that, and those are all going to be factors. Let's talk about trademark infringement. The DMCA does not protect you against trademark infringement. So if there is an infringement going on with respect to somebody's trademark on your site based on content that Polly Pucker or somebody through the contest has submitted or one of our cheerleaders has submitted, there is liability to you. There is no safe harbor that's generally going to be made available to you. The DMCA does not apply to trademark infringement. Now, there might be certain ways that you can use trademarks, you know, for proper comparative purposes. Under California, there might be a nominative use defense, but generally, there's not going to be the kinds of protections available for copyright or defamation, which we'll get into in a moment, that you're going to find with respect to trademarks. So, the next slide really talks about these guidelines, rules, and terms of use. We've talked about making sure that Polly Pucker has their blog guidelines, want to have contest rules in place, you're going to have terms of use in place for your website. And again, I think many of you are probably familiar with the kinds of things that you want in the terms of use. And as we've outlined here, the importance is to stress that they may not submit any material that is copyrighted by a third party or a trademark owned by a third party unless they have consent. And even then, you may say, I don't even want to go there. I don't even want to permit them to do that. It can only be what they themselves create or originate. We've talked about the indemnity and the limited value of that. The website operator can reserve the right to reject any submission or remove content. That's something that you're going to want. Your terms of use are going to be probably your most valuable document to help you in terms of certain types of defenses together with the vetting process. Let's talk about defamation and the rights of privacy and publicity. Defamation. Really, what is that? For false or unprivileged statements that cause injury to somebody. But it is not right of publicity, and it isn't necessarily right of privacy. The issue with, if you kind of look at your content that's being submitted, whether again it's by Polly Pucker, anybody who's part of a website, contest, or any of the cheerleaders, think about three basic buckets. You've got the copyright bucket, you've got the trademark bucket, you've got the right of publicity bucket. We've talked about some of the protections to you in the copyright bucket, the trademark bucket. I don't think there are that many protections for you. Then you have the right of publicity bucket. I don't think you really have many protections for yourself in terms of the right of publicity. If Polly Pucker is out there in putting people's likenesses up there, or if somebody who is part of the contest is putting somebody's likeness, image, voice, performance up there, I don't think you're going to have any kind of defenses generally available to you under the Communications Decency Act. And let's talk about that now. The Communications Decency Act is really something that provides immunity for claims of defamation and certain other torts. So the question is, we've just talked about what defamation is. What are some of the torts that it might provide immunity from? Generally speaking, from an advertiser point of view, I don't think many of those torts are going to apply to advertisers, given just the nature of the sites that they use. For example, immunity from liability for certain alleging harm for certain types of actions. Certain kinds of pornography, you're not going to permit that on your site anyway. Certain other types of policies and practices that you have, I don't think it's going to provide, those torts it might provide you with protection. It hasn't, the CDA, which is a short term for Communications Decency Act hasn't really tested the whole right of publicity except in one particular case. And I think the case law to date that is very, very limited and where it is going to be headed based on statements that have been made is that you are not going to be able to fold in a right of publicity or a trademark claim on a state basis into a CDA immunity defense. So I think while the CDA is important, and if you have a claim, you would raise that as a defense of immunity, but I don't think you should go to the bank with the CDA on anything other than really defamation. And what you do with defamation will, if you are actually exercising control over those remarks of that person, that's going to limit your immunity defense with respect to the CDA. So we've talked about the exposure in that third bucket now, the right of publicity bucket. Now, let's talk about the advertising laws and user-generated content, something that I've mentioned right from the start as I think an issue. Are the claims made in Polly's blog, many movies considered advertising? I think while there has been no formal statement issued, I think we have to assume as advertisers and agencies that it would be deemed a form of advertising. It's commercial speech. Same thing for those contest submissions. You might be able to make certain defenses that it's not, but I think you need to go in to this with the considering this to really be advertising and commercial speech and afforded fewer protections. And that means your claims have to be substantiated. They can't be false and misleading. So whatever the cheerleaders say, whatever Polly says, whatever you post as part of a submission, I love no milk chocolate and it cured my cancer or the like, it's an advertisement. And you also have to follow the testimonial guidelines. Exactly. Now, there have been a number of cases. I've outlined those, the Quiznos sandwich case. There's a detailed discussion on that in the papers that are going to be available to you. I encourage you to read that. And then we've obviously talked about the word-of-mouth advertising issues with respect to the FTC guidelines, testimonials, and certainly making sure that cheerleaders are properly identified and the proper disclosures are made. And I made reference here to the license to the Word of Mouth Marketing Association. So let's just talk about some of the, just to kind of close it up, and then I'd like to get to some questions. What's the value of I raised at the beginning, you've now worked through the scenarios with your client. You're the lawyer, and some of you are the marketing people talking about what are some of the issues. Am I going to license it? Am I going to own it? Certainly, you want a very, very broad license if that's the way to go. The license, I think, will depend on what you use it for. For example, as I indicated earlier, I think people are more likely not to make submissions of music if they know it's going to be owned. They're more likely to be comfortable with licensing. One of the other issues is that depending on what kind of submissions people will make, you may get complaints from people that the grant is too broad in terms of the license. So what do you really need this license for with respect to this submission? Is it with respect to this particular program, or do you want to reserve for yourself the right to use this in other materials down the road? One of the other issues, which is in terms of the writing requirement, under the Copyright Act, in order for ownership to properly transfer to you, there must be a writing. Now, is my doing a click wrap agreement or an I accept, is that a writing? I think depending on who you talk to, you might get different points of view of that. I would certainly recommend that if you are going to want to maintain ownership, let's say of the five works that are in each of, certainly of Polly's, Pucker's work, but if you want to maintain ownership of the submissions that were made as part of the contest, get an affidavit for those people to sign and get a transfer of all rights as part of that affidavit and have it signed by them. In terms of contracting with minors, this is a product that we are looking to appeal, particularly through Polly Pucker, to teenagers. They're minors. As many of you know, minors can void a contract. How do you maintain the enforceability of that contract against them? Sometimes I think you just take the risk and decide what are our vulnerabilities if that contract is deemed void. In other cases, what you might do, particularly if somebody is making a submission and is one of the five selected entries, you would have the parent sign on that and make warranties and representations on behalf of the minor. So, with that, let's now turn it over to some Q&As. Let me remind all of you, there is a chat feature that's available, and so if you would like to submit questions, you're welcome to do so. Okay. One of the questions that we've had is, what is the value of an indemnity from the user? From a legal point of view, I think it's of extremely limited value, and you could even argue that it's of no value. I think it's because of the resources that that a user would have with respect to support an indemnity. And I think it raises another issue. Are you going to want to be in the position of actually going out and suing a user of your site from a PR perspective? How does that look? Do you really want to dedicate resources to that? And does that really make sense? So I think there is very limited value from a legal point of view to that, and I think there's potential PR consequences if you were to pursue a suit. However, there is some value in an indemnity in terms of holding people to a high standard. If they know that they are likely to be held liable, they may be less likely to make a submission that they know is infringing, or may exercise greater diligence in making that submission. One of the things that I should mention as part of the registration process is typically, and there's this a little bit of a tension that sometimes takes place. As a lawyer, I always want, when people register, I want as much information about that person as possible. Because I want to be able, if that person's making a submission of infringing material, I want a way to contact that person. And also, people are less likely, when they have to give you detailed information about themselves, and what I'm referring to is street address, like as a way of contacting you, that they're less likely to make a submission of infringing material. However, from a marketing point of view, there's real tension about that. They're saying that's too much. We want to make this easy for them. We want them to be able to make their submission fairly easily, so the only thing that we're going to ask for is an email address. And I get that from a marketing perspective. What that limits you to is an inability to maybe to go after that infringer and to really police infringing materials as effectively as you like. But I freely admit that the marketing approach is, you know, less requiring right people to use less material. So let's see what other questions can we have. Let me just bear with me for a minute. Okay, there's a question here. In a contest that includes user-generated content, is it better to have judges select a winner, or is it better to allow public voting? That really goes more to a promotions question as opposed to a user-generated contest. I will address it, though, by the following. There is a split, I think, among certain practitioners in the industry on this particular issue. For something to be qualified properly as promotions in compliance with contest laws, the argument is that you have to have clear criteria so people know how they're going to be judged, and you have to have qualified judges applying that criteria equally across the board in order for it to be a true contest. So the question becomes, if somebody is a member of the public, are they really a qualified judge, and are you introducing the element of chance? The argument is that I think I appreciate that as a technical argument and a theoretical argument. It may at some point become a real argument, but in the present regulatory environment, I don't think most regulators view public voting, depending on the specific type of promotion that you're working on, as in and of itself problematic. There may be types of public voting that are problematic, but not necessarily in and of itself. One other question that's come up, next question is, what is the NAD's position and role with regard to claims made in user-generated content and word-of-mouth advertising? I haven't specifically talked to the NAD about this, but having our firm has worked on a number of NAD cases, and I feel fairly confident. Terry Seligman is somebody who has done a number of those cases. I feel fairly confident that the NAD would take the position that if it is a claim made as part of your user-generated content that is being submitted to a site that you own or control, that you are going to be responsible for that and making sure that that is substantiated and is going to be as if you have made that claim yourself. Same thing, I think, with if you're directing people through word of mouth advertising, because theoretically you can provide them with some conduct and control. I think it becomes more, so I think their position is going to be consistent with the FTC's position. I think in terms of the, you know, do you have a responsibility, would an NAD take the position that you have a responsibility to seek out other sites and see what they're saying about you? Not necessarily. So let's look at some of these other questions. We've got quite a few questions, so unfortunately we're not going to be able to get to all of them. Let me see if I can find a few that might be representative. Question. While an advertiser may not be directly financially benefiting from copyright infringing user-generated content, isn't the site operator, e.g. the site operator is generating high volumes of traffic from infringing content and thus able to sell and place ads on a page with an infringing content? I think that's an excellent question. The answer is yeah, that's a factor. And I think it's really going to depend on whether the advertiser placing sites, ads on that page where there's infringing content. I think if they are placing ads, I think that does become a factor. Are you benefiting? If I were bringing a claim against an advertiser on that particular issue, I would certainly point to that, and it's going to be one of the factors that the court would consider in determining whether or not the advertiser could avail itself of that safe harbor. There is another question here. If the cheerleaders are not paid but rather treated as influencers that may blog on their own, do you need to disclose you have a relationship with them? What if you link to their blog? Two questions there. I do think, again, you're hearing it from a lawyer here, and one of the things I should qualify is this is how I would advise somebody, and other lawyers may advise differently, but you take into account all the different factors. My own recommendation would be, yes, you do need to disclose that you have a relationship with them because you've induced them to become influencers by providing them with the chocolate. You have a relationship with them. There needs to be a transparency there. If you link to their blog, I think the position would be, yes, you have liability for what they say, even though it's a link. And it doesn't necessarily reside, you know, within your site itself. With regards to the UGC, what if you do not own or control the site, and there are claims made by word of mouth hired third parties that are not true? The issue on that, brings up for me a couple of questions. One is, if you don't own or control the site, there are claims made by word of mouth hired third parties that are not true. I still think that a regulator would take the position that if they are, if you've hired them for word of mouth and their statements are not true, even if they do not appear on your site, I think the FTC's position would be that you are liable. Again, not a formal position. I don't think they're taking specific action on this right yet. I think they're kind of, they're taking a wait-and-see attitude. But I think it's something that you should anticipate that there's potential exposure. And similar question, does the advertiser need to police other social networks, such as Facebook, for pages that use the advertiser's TM copyright material, even if you did not create it? I certainly think that would be important for an advertiser to do. The question will be whether how feasible it is in terms of your ability to police. But as the owner of a trademark, let's say that you are an advertiser, as the owner of a trademark, you are liable, you are responsible for policing that mark, so you need to be out there and police it. Respect to copyright material, yes, you really should be able, you should monitor sites to see where you are. And see what uses are being made of that copyrighted work. What becomes an interesting issue is, let's say, this is very common, advertisers' work appear on the YouTube site. Sometimes advertisers place it on that site. Sometimes the commercials appear on that site. What's the advertiser's liability? Well, it really becomes an issue in terms of third-party rights. SAG's position on that, if you've got a commercial on YouTube, they're going to want to see you issue a cease and desist to YouTube. Otherwise, they're going to make a claim against you for residuals. And if that talent's been released, then you arguably also have a potential issue from the talent saying that you are liable because that appears. Now, I would take the position to the talent, you don't have liability. I would take the position to the union that, you know, we have no control over what put up on our website, up on the YouTube website. Therefore, it doesn't trigger any obligations on our part to pay you any guild fees or otherwise. If we had actively placed that, that would be a different story. But that's a perfect example of kind of where the jury is out. Are you? Because what happens a lot of times is advertisers are actually not unhappy about the fact that that commercial appears on the YouTube site, even though they didn't actively place it there. So there is some potential exposure there and some potential issues. Unfortunately, it's 2 o'clock, and I think we're going to get cut off. But I want to thank everybody for participating in the webinar. We've had a tremendous participation, a lot of great questions. If people have questions that they want to talk about in a little more detail, they're welcome to contact me at jtaylor@loeb.com or tseligman@loeb.com, and if we can, we'll respond. I can't promise that we'll make a response depending on the nature of the question. Again, thank you everybody for your participation. It's been terrific for us.